Chapter 5. Crushed by one blow of the sea like a walnut shell, and there it hung dangling in the air. A mere faggot of crazy boards. The planking of the paddle boxes had been torn sheer away. The wheels were exposed and bare, and they whirled and dashed their spray about the decks at random. Chimney, white with crusted salt, topmast struck, storm sails set, rigging all knotted, tangled, wet, and drooping. A gloomier picture it would be hard to look upon. I was now comfortably established by courtesy in the ladies' cabin, where, besides ourselves, there were only four other passengers. First, the little Scotch lady before mentioned, on her way to join her husband at New York, who had settled there 3 years before. Secondly and thirdly, an honest young Yorkshireman, connected with some American house, domiciled in that same city, and carrying thither his beautiful young wife to whom he had been married but a fortnight, and who was the fairest specimen of a comely English country girl I have ever seen. Fourthly, fifthly, and lastly, another couple, newly married to, if one might judge from the endearments they frequently interchanged, of whom I know no more than that they were rather a mysterious, runaway kind of couple, that the lady had great personal attractions also, and that the gentleman carried more guns with him than Robinson Crusoe, wore a shooting coat, and had two great dogs on board. On further consideration, I remember that he tried hot roast pig, and bottled ale as a cure for seasickness, and that he took these remedies usually in bed, day after day, with astonishing perseverance. I may add, for the information of the curious, that they decidedly failed. The weather continuing obstinately and almost unprecedentedly bad, we usually straggled into this cabin, more or less faint and miserable, about an hour before noon, and lay down on the sofas to recover, during which interval, the captain would look in to communicate the state of the wind, the moral certainty of its changing. Tomorrow the weather is always going to improve tomorrow, at sea, the vessel's rate of sailing, and so forth. Observations there were none to tell us of, for there was no sun to take them by. But a description of one day will serve for all the rest. Here it is. The captain being gone, we compose ourselves to read, if the place be light enough, and if not, we doze and talk alternately. At one, a bell rings, and the stewardess comes down with a steaming dish of baked potatoes, and another of roasted apples, and plates of pig's face, cold ham, salt beef, or perhaps a smoking mess of rare hot collops. We fall to upon these dainties, eat as much as we can. We have great appetites now, and are as long as possible about it. If the fire will burn, it will sometimes. We are pretty cheerful. If it won't, we all remark to each other that it's very cold, rub our hands, cover ourselves with coats and cloaks, and lie down again to doze, talk, and read, provided as aforesaid, until dinner time. At 5, another bell rings, and the stewardess reappears with another dish of potatoes boiled this time and store of hot meat of various kinds. Not forgetting the roast pig, to be taken medicinally. We sit down at table again, rather more cheerfully than before, prolong the meal with a rather moldy dessert of apples, grapes, and oranges, and drink our wine and brandy and water. The bottles and glasses are still upon the table, and the oranges, and so forth are rolling about according to their fancy and the ship's way, when the doctor comes down, by special nightly invitation, to join our evening rubber. Immediately on whose arrival we make a party at whist, and as it is a rough night, and the cards will not lie on the cloth, we put the tricks in our pockets as we take them. At whist we remain with exemplary gravity, deducting a short time for tea and toast, until 11 o'clock, or thereabouts, when the captain comes down again, in a sou'wester hat tied under his chin, and a pilot coat, making the ground wet where he stands. By this time the card playing is over, and the bottles and glasses are again upon the table, and after an hour's pleasant conversation about the ship, the passengers, and things in general, the captain, who never goes to bed, and is never out of humor, turns up his coat collar for the deck again, shakes hands all round, and goes laughing out into the weather as merrily as to a birthday party. As to daily news, there is no dearth of that commodity. This passenger is reported to have lost 14 pounds at Vingdayun in the saloon yesterday, and that passenger drinks his bottle of champagne every day, and how he does it, being only a clerk, nobody knows. The head engineer has distinctly said that there never was such times, meaning weather, and four good hands are ill, and have given in, dead beat. Several berths are full of water, and all the cabins are leaky. The ship's cook, secretly swigging damaged whiskey, has been found drunk, and has been played upon by the fire engine until quite sober. All the stewards have fallen downstairs at various dinner times, and go about with plasters in various places. The baker is ill, and so is the pastry cook. A new man, horribly indisposed, has been required to fill the place of the latter officer, and has been propped and jammed up with empty casks in a little house upon deck, and commanded to roll out pie crust, which he protests, being highly bilious, it is death to him to look at. News. A dozen murders on shore would lack the interest of these slight incidents at sea. Divided between our rubber and such topics as these, we were running, as we thought, into Halifax Harbor, on the 15th night, with little wind and a bright moon indeed. We had made the light at its outer entrance, and put the pilot in charge, when suddenly the ship struck upon a bank of mud. An immediate rush on deck took place, of course. The sides were crowded in an instant, and for a few minutes we were in as lively a state of confusion as the greatest lover of disorder would desire to see. The passengers, and guns, and water casks, and other heavy matters, being all huddled together aft, however, to lighten her in the head, she was soon got off, and after some driving on towards an uncomfortable line of objects whose vicinity had been announced very early in the disaster by a loud cry of breakers ahead. ... and much backing of paddles, and heaving of the lead into a constantly decreasing depth of water, we dropped anchor in a strange outlandish-looking nook which nobody on board could recognize, although there was land all about us, and so close, that we could plainly see the waving branches of the trees. It was strange enough, in the silence of midnight, and the dead stillness, that seemed to be created by the sudden and unexpected stoppage of the engine which had been clanking and blasting in our ears incessantly for so many days, to watch the look of blank astonishment expressed in every face, beginning with the officers, tracing it through all the passengers, and descending to the very stokers and furnacemen, who emerged from below, one by one, and clustered together in a smoky group about the hatchway of the engine room, comparing notes in whispers. After throwing up a few rockets and firing signal guns in the hope of being hailed from the land, or at least of seeing a light, but without any other sight or sound presenting itself, it was determined to send a boat on shore. It was amusing to observe how very kind some of the passengers were, in volunteering to go ashore in this same boat. For the general good, of course. Not by any means, because they thought the ship in an unsafe position, or contemplated the possibility of her heeling over in case the tide were running out. Nor was it less amusing to remark how desperately unpopular the poor pilot became in one short minute. He had had his passage out from Liverpool, and during the whole voyage had been quite a notorious character, as a teller of anecdotes and cracker of jokes. Yet here were the very men who had laughed the loudest at his jests, now flourishing their fists in his face, loading him with imprecations, and defying him to his teeth as a villain. The boat soon shoved off, with a lantern and sundry blue lights on board, and in less than an hour returned, the officer in command bringing with him a tolerably tall young tree, which he had plucked up by the roots, to who satisfy certain distrustful passengers whose minds misgave them that they were to be imposed upon and shipwrecked, and who would on no other terms believe that he had been ashore, or had done anything but fraudulently row a little way into the mist, specially to deceive them, and compass their deaths. Our captain had foreseen from the first that we must be in a place called the Eastern Passage, and so we were. It was about the last place in the world in which we had any business or reason to be, but a sudden fog, and some error on the pilot's part, were the cause. We were surrounded by banks, and rocks, and shoals of all kinds, but it happily drifted, it seemed, upon the only safe speck that was to be found thereabouts. Eased by this report, and by the assurance that the tide was past the ebb, we turned in at 3 o'clock in the morning. I was dressing about 9:30 next day, when the noise above hurried me on deck. When I had left it overnight, it was dark, foggy, and damp, and there were bleak hills all round us. Now, we were gliding down a smooth, broad stream, at the rate of 11 miles an hour. Our colors flying gaily, our crew rigged out in their smartest clothes, our officers in uniform again, the sun shining, as on a brilliant April day in England. The land stretched out on either side, streaked with light patches of snow, white wooden houses, people at their doors, telegraphs working, flags hoisted, wharfs appearing, ships, quays crowded with people, distant noises, shouts, men and boys running down steep places towards the pier, all more bright and gay and fresh to our unused eyes than words can paint them. We came to a wharf, paved with uplifted faces, got alongside, and were made fast, after some shouting and straining of cables, darted, a score of us along the gangway, almost as soon as it was thrust out to meet us, and before it had reached the ship, and leaped upon the firm glad earth again. I suppose this Halifax would have appeared an Elysium, though it had been a curiosity of ugly dullness. But I carried away with me a most pleasant impression of the town and its inhabitants, and have preserved it to this hour. Nor was it without regret that I came home, without having found an opportunity of returning thither, and once more shaking hands with the friends I made that day. It happened to be the opening of the Legislative Council and General Assembly, at which ceremonial the forms observed on the commencement of a new session of Parliament in England were so closely copied, and so gravely presented on a small scale, that it was like looking at Westminster through the wrong end of a telescope. The Governor, as Her Majesty's representative, delivered what may be called the speech from the throne. He said what he had to say manfully and well. The military band outside the building struck up God Save the Queen with great vigor before His Excellency had quite finished. The people shouted. The Inns rubbed their hands. The Outs shook their heads. The government party said there never was such a good speech. The opposition declared there never was such a bad one. The Speaker and members of the House of Assembly withdrew from the bar, to say a great deal among themselves, and do a little. And, in short, everything went on, and promised to go on, just as it does at home upon the like occasions. The town is built on the side of a hill, the highest point being commanded by a strong fortress, not yet quite finished. Several streets of good breadth and appearance extend from its summit to the water side, and are intersected by cross streets running parallel with the river. The houses are chiefly of wood. The market is abundantly supplied, and provisions are exceedingly cheap. The weather being unusually mild at that time for the season of the year, there was no sleighing. But there were plenty of those vehicles in yards and by places, and some of them, from the gorgeous quality of their decorations, might have gone on without alteration as triumphal cars in a melodrama at Astley's. The day was uncommonly fine, the air bracing and healthful, the whole aspect of the town cheerful, thriving, and industrious. We lay there 7 hours, to deliver and exchange the mails. At length, having collected all our bags and all our passengers, including two or three choice spirits, who, having indulged too freely in oysters and champagne, were found lying insensible on their backs in unfrequented streets. The engines were again put in motion, and we stood off for Boston. Encountering squally weather again in the Bay of Fundy, we tumbled and rolled about as usual all that night and all next day. On the next afternoon, that is to say, on Saturday, the 22nd of January, an American pilot boat came alongside, and soon afterwards the Britannia steam packet, from Liverpool, 18 days out, was telegraphed at Boston. The indescribable interest with which I strained my eyes, as the first patches of American soil peeped like molehills from the green sea, and followed them, as they swelled, by slow and almost imperceptible degrees, into a continuous line of coast, can hardly be exaggerated. A sharp keen wind blew dead against us, a hard frost prevailed on shore, and the cold was most severe. Yet the air was so intensely clear, and dry, and bright, that the temperature was not only endurable, but delicious. How I remained on deck, staring about me, until we came alongside the dock, and how, though I had had as many eyes as Argus, I should have had them all wide open, and all employed on new objects, are topics which I will not prolong this chapter to discuss. Neither will I more than hint at my foreigner-like mistake in supposing that a party of most active persons, who scrambled on board at the peril of their lives as we approached the wharf, were newsmen, answering to that industrious class at home. Whereas, despite the leathern wallets of news slung about the necks of some, and the broadsheets in the hands of all, they were editors, who boarded ships in person, as one gentleman in a worsted comforter informed me, because they liked the excitement of it. Apostrophe suffice it in this place to say, that one of these invaders, with a ready courtesy for which I thank him here most gratefully, went on before to order rooms at the hotel, and that when I followed, as I soon did, I found myself rolling through the long passages with an involuntary imitation of the gait of Mr. T.P. Cook, in a new nautical melodrama. "Dinner, if you please," apostrophe said I to the waiter. "When?" apostrophe said the waiter. "As quick as possible," apostrophe said one. "Right away?" apostrophe said the waiter. After a moment's hesitation, I answered no, apostrophe at hazard. "Not right away?" apostrophe cried the waiter, with an amount of surprise that made me start. I looked at him doubtfully, and returned, "No, I would rather have it in this private room. I like it very much." Apostrophe, at this, I really thought the waiter must have gone out of his mind. As I believe he would have done, but for the interposition of another man, who whispered in his ear, directly. Apostrophe, "Well, and that's a fact." Apostrophe said the waiter, looking helplessly at me. "Right away." Apostrophe, I saw now that right away, and directly were one, and the same thing. So I reversed my previous answer, and sat down to dinner in 10 minutes afterwards. And a capital dinner it was. The hotel, a very excellent one, is called the Tremont House. It has more galleries, colonnades, piazzas, and passages than I can remember, or the reader would believe. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.